Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Billy Mann. Billy is a Grammy-nominated songwriter, record producer, creative exec, music publisher, and founder CEO of the independent music publishing company Green and Bloom Topline. He's written songs for or produced records with an array of notable artists, including the likes of Pink, John Legend, the Backstreet Boys, Cher, Sting, Celine Dion, and many others. Since penning his first top 10 hit in the UK for EMI in 1995 with Three is Family by Dana Dawson, Billy has racked up several top 40 hits around the world, including several top 10s and number 1s, with cumulative album sales of over 110 million, an admirable achievement. Welcome to the show, Billy.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
It's really great to have you. Billy, I like
Appreciate
to start by saying that I think having a trusted advisor is so important, and I am a little biased in that department. Who have been some of your mentors along the way, and have you ever mentored others?
I mean, I think inherently, you know, if you get the privilege of being able to continue in the music industry for a extended period of time, I heard a great expression that Kevin Spacey said that when you actually reach a certain level in your career at a certain altitude, it's your obligation to send the elevator back down. And I feel that, you know, for the most part, I think you'll find that people that are successful in music, when you do get to a certain altitude, I think most people do a pretty decent job at doing that. So in terms of my own mentors that I've had over the years, they vary because musically Sting has been a mentor. David Foster has been a mentor. Grover Washington Jr. was my first mentor, who was a legendary Grammy-winning jazz crossover saxophonist.
Of course.
And then I've had mentors like my high school music teacher was Mr. David King, who was not just my mentor, but he was also the mentor for The Roots, Boys to Men, Christian McBride. Like, I think that as my career has changed over time, there are different mentors in different facets of my career, only because I'm a bit of an outlier in that I've been on all sides of the table. So musically, that's where I've been, and on the executive side and on the business side, it's been an incredible array of different lawyers and managers. I mean, Roger Davies as a manager is an amazing, I mean, he's one of the best and, you know, quiet about it, but wildly successful. Gary Shiffman, who's...
He's got artists like Pink and Cher and Tina Turner, for example.
Yes, well, but it's not just the level of artists he works with, it's the longevity of those relationships. It's the depth of his vision in working with those artists that's really telling.
Yes.
And, you know, and along the way, just a host of really amazing folks. It's a business that is not, the reputation of the music business is not a pretty one, and it's not a really pretty business. But I really have found some extraordinary people, really wonderful people.
Yeah, I would agree. I've been fortunate in that regard as well. And in my case, you know, being a woman in such a male-dominated industry, that and technology, two industries that are male-dominated, I can speak to the power of having had terrific mentors, as we discussed earlier, one of mine, Neil Portnow. You need that for all kinds of reasons when you're coming up, and then you do have an obligation to pay it forward. I agree with Kevin Spacey. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing you may not be aware about me, Billy, is I had a partnership for many years with Todd Rundgren. And the reason I bring that up is I'm curious who and what were some of your early music influences as a young person growing up in Philly?
I mean, well, Todd is amazing. I mean, he's an amazing singer-songwriter. And I, Hall & Oates also,
obviously,
actually collaborated and toured with Todd even as recently as the past 10 years.
Indeed.
And I one of my sort of, what I feel is one of my coolest achievements for me personally, and was that I had written Do It for Love with Daryl and John, which was the first number one that they had had after pretty much, I want to say, many, many, many years of not getting success and traction on radio. And it was also very much ahead of its time in that when they released that record, they did it all independently. So today, where we live in a world where artists are exploring all different kinds of ways to release and market their music to their fans, Hall & Oates were really unsung innovators in that regard, and that's a crowning achievement for me personally, because I'm from Philly, and but also because they were not just mentors, but I grew up on them. And then I got to work with Carole King, who also is one of my mentors. That was a real thrill for me. Sting was a real thrill for me. I gotta tell you, it's like it doesn't seem real even when I talk about it now. None of it really seems real, but I'd say Philadelphia is such a musical city in general that if you grow up there and music is a part of who you are, then, you know, songwriting is, you know, a part of who you are as an artist, that, you know, having one bare foot on asphalt is a part of who you are. It's like a place for artists, and it was great for me.
I think so, too. It was a phenomenal place to have come from. Now, after graduating college, you actually started out as a street musician, playing multiple instruments that you taught yourself, much like, say, Todd and Prince. Did your parents have anything to say about this?
I was really independent, really young. So, while I, you know, my parents, I will say I'm very lucky that my parents my parents split up when I was really little. I was very independent from a really young age. Like, Philadelphia is like, if you live in the inner city where I grew up, you're a little kid, hangs out on the street. You hang out on like a street corner or with your friends, you play stickball. It's very Rocky Balboa sort of woven into the DNA.
Yeah.
But my parents really didn't look at me. My parents never looked at me in a way that sort of said, you can't. I think, you know, fortunately, they really knew how passionate I was about music from a really young age. And I think they more just thought, be responsible. But, you know, they really didn't get in my way. I don't think anybody would have been able to anyway, so they were probably wise.
I hear you. I was the same way. I knew what I wanted to do at the age of 8. I wanted to be a record producer in the spirit of George Martin. And 8 years old, and wasn't anybody going to talk me out of that. Except that when I got old enough to hit Hollywood, I found out that it was a closed field for women. So I wound up going into A&R instead under Neil at EMI.
Mm. But, well, I mean, you were lucky that you had Neil, who's a good man, and
to be sure, but I shared your passion from a young age of just being laser focused on that being my path, and so I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, the next question I have for you is a little bit sensitive, but it does kind of remind me of Daryl Hall's situation. Your second solo album, Earthbound, came out in 1998, not long after the loss of your first wife. And I wonder if you would say that album was inspired by her, and whether it was tough to make music in that difficult time or whether it turned out to be a healing experience.
It was all of the above. I mean, I think that, it was listen, Earthbound was about grieving. I was really young. It's like I was really young and really in love and really didn't see it coming. And cancer and, you know, other, you know, the wonderful thing about life is you never know what's coming next, and either that's the most wonderful thing and you take the adventure, or you are so afraid of it that you never actually go out and live it. So I'm happy that I chose the former, but I wish I could tell you that I was prepared for the kind of grieving that was in store for me, but I wasn't. And Earthbound was a vehicle for me to grieve, and it was an opportunity where I was able to work with the musicians that I grew up with, literally record. You know, Steve Wolfe was a drummer I grew up with in Philly, who's now arguably one of the most successful session drummers in the world.
Sure.
But we played in bands together since we were little kids. Adam Dorn, whose father was Joel Dorn, who's also known as Motion Worker, played bass. He's one of the most amazing, talented people. Paul Pimsleur played guitar with me for I don't even know how many years. I mean, it went through, and it was comfort food, and that's what I needed during that time. And even Carole King and her involvement on a couple of songs, and it wasn't a commercially successful record, but it was a very I am indebted to A&M Records and to the people that were with me during that period.
Yeah.
Because it was, something that people say, it's like art is a labor of love. This was a very heavy experience, and a lot of really wonderful people stuck by me. And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You were very fortunate, Billy.
Yeah, no, I was very fortunate, but I didn't have a choice. You know, I couldn't write about fluffy, happy party things. My life didn't feel that way. But what was meaningful is that it did manage to reach people, and the people that I did get to reach and the artists I got to tour with, who supported me, they gave me their shoulders, and that gave me the opportunity to move on to another exciting chapter of my career.
Yeah, and we're going to go there in a second. But before we do, I just want to say, again, I think you were very fortunate to be at A&M. You know, Herb Alpert stands alone as far as I'm concerned. And if anybody understands loss, just look at the man on the heels of Karen Carpenter passing away 32 years ago.
Mm.
I mean,
mm.
He's never gotten over that. So, and she was just one of his artists. It wasn't his wife, you know? So
the chairman of the company at that time was a guy called Al Cafaro. And
right.
Al was really particularly wonderful to me.
Yeah.
And I also realized that I didn't want to be a famous person, which, by the way, is a really good thing. If you're thinking about being an artist, you should think that through. It seems good on paper, but in reality, it can be something else. And it wasn't for me.
Yeah, I mean, you've earned your stripes in every way imaginable, but you're kind of one of those pay no attention to the guy behind the curtain, and I say that with all due affection, because
thank you. I take that with absolute appreciation and respect.
You know, I always said to Todd, we'd go shopping somewhere, and Todd would pull out his American Express card, and when the person on the other side of the counter didn't know who he was, I almost fainted every time. But he was like, "I'll take the fortune over the fame," and I really get that. Now, you founded Stealth Entertainment in 2001, Billy, where your team developed, multi-platinum award-winning, chart-topping artists, songwriters, producers, and mixing engineers, people like Andy Zula and Christopher Rojas, and again, Stealth was later acquired. What were some of the key things you looked for to identify talent at an early stage in that cycle? And were there any deal breakers during Stealth's tenure?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the first thing I'd say to you is I called Stealth, frankly, because I was having a good run as a writer-producer, and I was starting to get that momentum. And I also had a real hunger and still have a real hunger around the business. But the music industry itself is very bucket-oriented. You're sort of like in the creative guy bucket, the artist bucket, the songwriter, producer bucket, the manager bucket, the executive bucket. And,
right.
You know, people don't like it when one kind of persona winds up in the wrong bucket.
Right.
Because it's just the way that the industry is siloed, and it's much less so now than it was then. But I was really nervous because if the A&R people found out that I actually owned the business that was managing me, or if they found out that I was involved in these other things, I was concerned that it would change how they engaged with me. And in some cases, it did. So stealth was sort of a joke because it was like I didn't want anybody to see it. And part of the way I built it is because I used my own money to build the company was I thought of a sort of dream team of who I'd want. So, for example, like Johnny Wright, who is a wildly successful pop manager who managed Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Justin Timberlake still, and I thought, man, that would be the ultimate hire. But since I am not Richard Branson at this point, what can I afford? And what I did is I went to Johnny's assistant, was a guy called Nick Bolton, and who I had known from working on the Backstreet Boys record, and said, you know, Nick, why don't you come and you can have like a real interest in this business and make decisions and not be, you know, an operational sort of right-hand guy. You can be up front. And that's what I did throughout the company is I'd hire the assistant to the – it's like it was the understudy to Michael Jordan, the understudy to Scottie Pippen, the understudy to all these players. And that's how it started. And it was great. I think that the deal-breaker part of it was recognizing that the revenue streams that were going to make the company successful weren't going to come from the traditional record business model. And this is – back in 2002, 2003, and really when this started to take place, 2004, because the challenge that I got to was that, you know, the revenue was coming from other places. And that's really where we started to find the success. Instead of focusing on a slice of the pie, which would be, let's say, just record sales alone, we started looking at the entire pie, which is, you know, brand partnerships, touring, publishing, producers, mixing engineers. And it was the whole of the experience that made the company profitable before we sold it.
Really, like a music 360 type orientation as opposed to a so-called artist 360, but really touching all the spokes on the wheel.
Right. And also, and it's inverted. So instead of being a company that's trying to fill in and rationalize 360 rights, we're actually getting, you know, the pieces that do the full spectrum of needs, whether it's production or mixing or A&R, and doing so and then engaging with the record company. And that, you know, just sequentially seemed healthier to me and still does.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, this is something that perhaps a mutual colleague of ours, my friend Terry McBride of Network, is obviously very passionate and outspoken about. You know, he's created a network, that kind of a company. Same thing. He calls it collapsed copyrights, where you have the management firm, the label, and the publishing all under one roof, and then you do deals with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that we're seeing a trend in that direction, and you were, once again, a little ahead of the curve, as he was in that regard. Now, in 2007, you moved over to EMI as a creative advisor, eventually becoming president of Global Artist Management, overseeing content on all continents. How important do you think this global perspective is in today's music industry, Billy? And again, this is something I know Terry is very outspoken about, that being global is a mandate. It's not an option anymore. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I just got off the phone with an executive at another company just before we started tonight, and I had this conversation that it still surprises me that record companies, and I say, I'm not picking on record companies, I'm saying just in general that the world in some ways still believes that there is this invisible curtain between one market to another. And at the moment we're working and developing with a bunch of acts that I'm very proud of, but one in particular is a kid named Jacob Whitesides. And Jacob Whitesides, if you go on Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram, he has in the aggregate millions of followers on these multiple platforms.
Right.
So we're looking to, so right now he's going to go on tour in May, his first European tour, and it's all generated by his social media following, and he released an EP the week after the Grammys. And with social media alone, no record company, no marketing promotion spent, he had a number five on, he was number five on the iTunes album chart the week after Grammys for several days, and number one on the iTunes singer-songwriter chart. But at the same time, he was number four in Portugal. He was in the top 20 in Mexico. He was in the top 40 in the UK. And in all of these countries, without any record companies, without anybody else involved, there was no separation. And so for me, the experience I had at EMI, and I had already spent a lot of time living overseas, living in Sweden, making records and executive producing projects for major labels internationally, but it really, let me tell you, I would tell anybody who is in any business, but particularly in the content business, is think globally. You can act locally with the understanding that what you do locally should be able to scale. And when you think of even the name or the domain of your company or the name of your project, that you want people to be able to figure out how to pronounce it in another language in another country, because it's remarkable. Passion is not it's not exclusive to one culture or another, especially when it comes to art. And I think that skill set, both on a practical sense in terms of running a business and driving a business with multicultural P&L, that gave real practical muscle to my skill set. But on a larger level, it really inspires me now and inspired me then to realize how music can travel, and it can travel faster now than it ever has in the past.
Well, that's for sure, and it is the only thing that is cross-cultural, because people hear music. You know, the lyrics might need to be translated, but the music is what moves people, and we are in the emotion business. So we're about moving people. You know, that's what we do. And to your point about making sure it's a name that you can pronounce cross-culturally, also make sure the name of the band doesn't translate to something offensive in another culture. You know? It'd be another
that's
problem.
Absolutely right.
Now, in 2011, you founded Mancom, which, of course, is a boutique management services company, alongside publishing venture with BMG Chrysalis, Green & Bloom, mm-hmm. Topline. Could you tell us a bit more about these companies?
Yes. Mancom is more sort of an umbrella that handles the management elements of the business. Green & Bloom Topline, and you can check us out at greenandbloom.net.
Okay.
I'm proud of the company for a host of reasons, musically, the team, the artists, but I'm really, what I wound up doing after 20 years of being a songwriter and producer, an artist and executive, and seeing all these different aspects of the business, I really asked myself, what is there a problem that I can solve? Is starting a new company that does publishing or does management, is that going to change anything substantive about the business? And I really wanted to think about how my particular narrative could make a difference for other artists and songwriters, like people that listen to your show. Could I add a different perspective, given the fact that I've been a literally starving artist who played on the street and then been in the boardroom of a multinational? And
right.
What I realized is that I wanted to create a community. I wanted to have a company that had a culture to it. I mean, basically, in today's traditional publishing model with the really huge companies, and I have been signed to most of them, own catalogs in most of them, partnered with most of them, and I've consulted for many of them, and I'm not saying that they're all bad. They're not all bad. There are some amazing people and certainly incredible artists and copyrights that are signed to publishing companies. But what I wanted to do was ask, if I started a publishing company, if I started something in music today, what could I bring to the table? What do I wish had happened to me when I started? And there was a kind of a list. I wrote down a list of the things. Like, one was that when I started, I had no money. So the money that they gave me, I got an advance when I first started. But I was so focused on the advance money that I didn't really understand that, you know, a lawyer negotiates a deal and they get paid their percentage for upfront for the life of the deal. The artist or songwriter has to live with the deal for life. Right?
And you may never recoup. Nobody ever tells you may never recoup.
But you know what? But the thing is, not recouping is not scary in the sense that what it means is that the company probably, you know, in most cases, maybe the company bet on the wrong horse. Maybe you didn't recoup because your music doesn't have the strength to do the heavy lifting. I see both sides of that.
Yeah.
But I also feel like I didn't understand the tax implications. I didn't understand that, you know, if I got $10,000, that $5,000 went to, you know, an accountant, $5,000 went to legal fees, and, you know, and then $15,000 to $20,000 went to a manager. And, you know, when you look at this, I'm just looking at broad numbers, you know, I didn't really understand the tax implications. I didn't understand budgeting myself.
Right.
I understood budgeting myself to live off of tuna fish and ramen noodles, but I didn't understand budgeting myself to see a longer picture. And so one of the things, by example, with Green and Bloom is I'll go dollar for dollar with any other publisher, base out the payments so that a songwriter learns to acclimate themselves to, I'll guarantee the money. And if they make money faster, I would fast track the money. But in most cases, what I really want to do is stabilize somebody.
Yes.
Because I think when creative people feel a sense of stability, I think that their work will increase. And if a lawyer or manager is participating in a percentage of a deal that they're out trying to procure for their client, if they aren't okay with commissioning every month a certain amount of money instead of getting it all up front, well, then you've got the wrong rep.
Yep.
Because the rep you want is the one who's in it for the long haul.
That's exactly right.
And so, you know, when I look at this, and that was one thing. So we have a rule. I do no front-load advancement. I will go toe-to-toe with anybody, but I won't do that. And if somebody wants it, they can go somewhere else. The other thing is that I want to provide opportunity for the writers to have access to each other in a really collaborative environment. So the motto of the company is no dicks, no divas, no drama.
Yep,
and if somebody breaks the rules, I say on signing anybody, I say, look, I know it's unorthodox, it's not like a corporate document, but if you belittle somebody else, if you judge somebody else in a negative way, if you bring negative energy into the company and people feel badly, then I'm going to be like every other publisher. I'm going to have your contract, I'm going to put it in a drawer, and we'll fulfill our fiduciary responsibilities. We'll do your admin. We'll, you know, we'll collect for you. We'll do it all responsibly. But all the added elements that we provide for you, we're just not going to put it on the table because we're going to save that for the people that are going to invest in themselves.
Right.
And ultimately, what I want to do and what I wanted to do is instead of creating a roster of dependents, I want a roster of independents. I want to look at each writer as a startup company, and each one of them is the CEO of what they do with their music. And what we need to do is provide scaffolding for them, leverage, network support, the global ability to collect for them, their administration, to explain to them. And the way that we compete is that we invest much earlier. And back to your original question about how do we find talent and at what stage and how do we attract them, is part of it is that we listen to other artists. And we started, you know, 3.5 years ago, we had two writers, myself being one of them. And today we have over 45 writers and over 3,000 copyrights. And that's without any catalog acquisition. That's just a community of writers that work incredibly well together. And it is, and it's awesome. I absolutely love it. And I love all the writers. And every signing that we have counts, and we're patient, and it's amazing.
It's the tortoise approach versus the hare. And I like the fact that the people that work with you, A, that you promote cross-pollination between them, and B, you really are co-creating with them for the long haul, and that's just paramount. You and Terry McBride, I'm sorry to keep bringing him up, but you're like peas in a pod, and I say that in the most complimentary way. because I can count on one hand how many people I can respect that have those kind of values and do business by them.
I really appreciate that. I haven't had the privilege of spending much time with Terry. I've met him once, I think briefly, during my executive years at EMI, but I have always heard great things about him.
Yeah, you guys are really in alignment on a lot of this stuff. Now, I'm mindful of our time, Billy. I just have two more questions for you. I understand you're on the board of Autism Speaks, and in fact, you've got a son who has autism. I've got a niece who has it. Is there something you wish to share with our listeners about how this has shaped you or something you wish everyone knew about autism?
First of all, Autism Awareness Month is April, and I appreciate you bringing it up. It's I'm on the board of Autism Speaks, which is really the largest umbrella organization in a community that's it's growing very fast. And anybody that looks up from wherever they are, if they don't know somebody who has autism, then they will find somebody, a family friend or a relative that is facing it. I think what I can only say to you is that when my son was diagnosed with autism, it was he's 12 and he was around 2, and statistically it was somewhere around 1 in 75, 1 in 200 kids were being diagnosed with autism. And in less than 10 years, it's gone from 1 in 200 to 1 in 166 to 1 in 150 to 1 in 10, 1 in 110 to 1 in 88 to now 1 in 68 and 1 in 43 boys.
Wow.
And the cost, like the impact to our economy, is extraordinary. And the bankruptcy rate for most families, if you imagine, the average middle-class family makes between $40,000 and $75,000 a year. Just the services alone for most families, it's tough. And I say to people often that had it been me diagnosed, raised by a single mom, growing up in inner-city Philadelphia, I wouldn't have had a chance. I don't know. I don't know if I'd be alive. I'd be in a state institution or a homeless person, probably not able to fend for myself. So what I can say to your listeners is I don't look at autism as it's like this horrible thing. I think it's a spectrum disorder. It means it's a snowflake disorder. No two individuals are the same. And there are some really high-functioning individuals in the autism community that are extraordinary, that make an incredible impact. And then there are kids like my son who are not very verbal and can't advocate for themselves and will grow up. And, hopefully my son will live for 90 more years. And the responsibility of that is enormous for any family, even a family of means like mine. So I guess I would just say to your listeners, to you, is that these numbers are growing very, very, very fast.
Yeah.
And you're in, Silicon Valley. The numbers are particularly high. They're high in Minneapolis. They're high in New Jersey, highest in New Jersey. But they're high all over the country. And I think that, what I'm hoping is that we look at these spectrum disorders more closely because it's a real challenge for millions of families.
There's no doubt about it. And you're doing great work for your part. So, again, kudos for putting your values and aligning those with your actions. Before we finish our chat, I have to ask you the most important question that I'd like to ask all my guests, and that is, for everything you've accomplished behind you, Billy, what comes next? What's the one project or collaboration maybe you haven't even started yet that you dream about creating as part of your legacy? God knows you've already got a well-oiled legacy as is.
Thank you. You're really kind. I've been working with Pink for over a decade, and she's really one of my life partners, one of my closest friends. I'm continuing work with her is always exciting for me. I would tell you that I'm very focused on sort of the concept of the hit life. I have met so many people in the music industry, and frankly, in the tech industry, the music industry, a lot of industries that are very focused on having the big hit. You know, the hit song. In the music industry, it's like, I want to have a hit song.
Right.
Very focused, like, I want to have a hit. And I have met a lot of people that are so monochromatic in their focus and their view on having a hit. And I say, like, for people that are really, really tenacious, if they're really focused on that, on getting a hit, one way or another, it may take them 25, 30 years.
Right.
But if they're good and decent people, they'll probably have a hit.
Yeah.
The challenge is I look at a lot of these folks, and when they get the hit, they're still not happy.
Exactly,
and it's
right.
Sort
at
of
what,
like,
cost? What cost?
It's at what cost, but it's also, it's like you miss so much. And what I can say, and I say to you, and I would say to anybody who's listening, is while I'm incredibly grateful to have a career in music, and I am, and I am thankful every day, I'm more thankful that I didn't sacrifice my commitment to having the full life experience. Like, I love my wife and partner. I love being a dad. I have four amazing kids. I love the people I work with. I have traveled. I have learned languages. I have tasted foods and spices that I never thought I'd try. And
yeah.
I feel like I know a lot of people. I don't say a lot of people. There are. I'm really lucky to have to continue to be successful and have had the success I've had. But I know a lot of successful people who see their success in terms of a hit song or hit song.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have more cars than I do, but I've got enough. And they may have more homes than I do, but I've got enough.
Yep.
But none of them are richer than me. None of them, when I look at them, I don't measure the success based on a metric provided to me by Billboard or SoundScan. And I really think that what I'm hoping is, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, that the message that I send to my family, my friends, and the artists I work with is that I'm conveying without preaching, but by being, that you can have success in music, you can have success in business, but you can also have success in working through being a great partner with somebody and having the full spectrum. So the choice to me is, I chose the hit life because I don't just have a hit song. I get the hit songs, I get the family, I get the life experience, and that's what I really want to focus on this next chapter of my life, is doing everything I can in business with the artists I work with, talking to people like you who are experts at what you do, and trying to encourage people to know that there's passion. There's passion in being successful, that if you have passion in your paycheck is worth a lot more than somebody who's wearing a suit and really hates what they do, or wearing whatever uniform and hates what they do. Each time you check that passion box, you are privileged. And that's
so
really
true.
What I want. That's really what
I love.
I want
it.
So
what you've shared, that is absolutely the nail on the head, Billy. And, I was privileged, having been the person that launched music at Apple, to have Steve Jobs as a mentor. And the journey really is the reward. And I think anybody who really gets that in their bones and lives by that is somebody who would echo exactly what you just shared. So I can't think of any way to top that. It's a great way for us to wrap up. And I want to thank you again for making the time to join me. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. I feel very privileged that I get asked for these things each time out. It's really it's a gift for me. So thank you.
Well, thank
and
you
I
kindly.
Really,
it's certainly been a gift for me.
Thank you, listeners, too.
Yeah, and
all
I,
right.
As always, I want to thank my show producer, Jessica Mastors, and, of course, our wonderful listeners. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.